Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Nall. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, continuing with our Conversations with Remarkable Minds series, the theological deification of capitalist markets, the secular quest for prosperity, and why we should be very concerned. My guest, Professor Harvey Cox. He is one of America's most preeminent theologians and the Hollis Research Professor Emeritus at Harvard Divinity School, the oldest professorship at Harvard going back to 1721. Professor Cox has been called one of the most important liberal theologians during the last half century and a leading trend spotter in American religion. He has also been a prominent civil rights and anti-war activist throughout his career. His book, The Secular City, published in 1965, remains one of the most read theological books in the nation and predicted much of what we now witness unfolding as dogmatic religious beliefs become stronger and secular values take on higher spiritual value and meaning. 40 years ago, Professor Cox viewed this as a maturing of humanity and a divine gift rather than a threat to religion. Now at 87 years of age, Professor Cox has published another text, The Market as God, which lays down the argument, along with Pope Francis' observation, that the capitalist market has been deified and has reached divine status in postmodern civilization, and consequently our ethical problems dealing with rampant inequality, climate change, and global poverty are more difficult to solve. Nice to have you with us today, Professor Cox.
Hey, yeah, it's great to be here. I love that stirring Wagnerian music at the beginning. I don't know whether you picked that out just for me or not.
Well, it's certainly the Flight of the Valkyries is certainly in the domain of what you discuss.
the Valkyries, right?
A few thoughts of what I feel are important for this audience. I take particular delight in having guests on the program who have reached their later years and have had distinguished careers and have lived constructive lives in the world of deep thought and reflection and introspection about the human condition. Why? Because they bring forth a certain degree of wisdom that is not present, in my opinion, in younger generations. And also, these are people who have narrowed their focus upon that which is most critical and urgent in society. Recently, Bishop John Spong was on this program, and he is also in his mid-80s, and he spoke of the urgency he felt in writing his latest opus, criticizing biblical literalism and denouncing it as a religious heresy. He believes strongly that this is what is contributing to the rise of militant religious fundamentalism that is completely unchristian-like and dangerous to society. Therefore, I'd like to begin by starting with a personal question. Now, I assume for the past several years, you have contemplated and focused intently on the dogmatic and religious mythology and theological characteristics that the free market economy, and capitalist markets in particular, has assigned to itself. And what observations or realizations do you have that compelled you to explore this subject more thoroughly? And did you have any sense of urgency during the course of your research?
Well, that's exactly right, Gary. It was just a few years ago that a friend of mine just said to me once in casual conversation, look, Harvey, if you really want to be in touch with what's going on in the world, you ought to be reading the Wall Street Journal, the business pages of the New York Times, the Financial Times, at least now and then, because that's when the most influential decisions are made. That's where you find out about them. The rest is a little bit derivative. So I started doing that just as a kind of a self-discipline in a way, and I thought I was going to find myself in completely foreign territory. And to my utter surprise, after spending most of my life reading comparative religion and theologies of the different religions, in my case especially Christian theology, I found all this stuff that seemed very familiar. It was a bit disguised. I mean, we talk about the ups and downs of the Dow, about acquisitions and losses, and about volatility and all of that. And I said, boy, all this sounds very much like things that I've been reading my whole life. And I began to look at it more carefully, and sure enough, behind the actual print of the business and financial news, there's a whole understanding of history. There's a view of what human beings are, what they're intended to be, what the good life should be like, and if you don't have the good life, how you can get it, where history is headed, what the enemies of the system are and why they're so dangerous and heretical. And they even like to use certain phrases and words that I've learned in the theological tradition. So I started thinking about this and making notes and thinking about even writing a book about it, when lo and behold, almost 3 years ago now, the new Pope Francis issued a pastoral statement, which he calls The Joy of the Gospel, Gaudium Evangelii, in which he says, look, this is all supposed to be good news. So why is it we have all this glumness and all this self-preoccupation? Why aren't we more joyful? And he goes on to answer his own question by saying that we are to a large extent trapped in this competitive commodity market system. And he goes, and he ends that paragraph by saying, it's a system in which there is a deified market, a deified market. Now, I had just thought about of this pseudo-religion, this ersatz religion that's coming through the consumer economy and presented to us that way, and wondered what the equivalent of God would be. And I thought, well, it's really the market. And in my new book, I use a capital M to show how much deference people accord this market, which is supposed to know everything, be very wise, always make the right decisions, distributes things, sets prices of everything from hotels to kidneys, has this vast, vast power. And we're supposed to put our confidence in it, even when it looks like it's doing some very destructive and stupid things. And I remember the old gospel song, further along we'll understand why. It may look like a mystery now. But the Pope says, look, the poor have been waiting year after year, decade after decade, while this trickle-down economic system is supposed to find its way to them, and they are still waiting, and it isn't happening. And let's raise some questions about this deified market. So, I'm not myself a Catholic, but I thought there's this old saying, when Rome has spoken, Roma locuta, the matter is closed, causa finita. And I thought, wow, if the Pope and I seem to be on the same page about this deified market, maybe that's a good signal to go ahead. So I went ahead with this book, and thankful that I'm on the same page with the Pope, or the Pope's on the same page with me. I don't care. I'm grateful that we're on the same page, seeing the issue before us in this vastly destructive economic system that we find ourselves in, with its increasing inequality that increases every year, its systematic destruction of the planet, its poisoning of our inner spiritual lives, all of that. Not just, he sees it, the Pope sees it, not just as a moral challenge, which it certainly is, but as a theological, religious challenge, as a counterfeit religious system. So I penned this book. Just came out this past week, published by Harvard University Press, and it's called The Market as God.
Okay, I appreciate those insights. I'm going to set up a little larger and broader construct for you to address, if you would, please. Much of your critique has been influenced by documents published by Pope Francis, especially when you said that he spoke about the deified market. And what he says specifically is, ideologies which defend the absolute autonomy of the marketplace tends to devour everything which stands in the way of increased profits. Now, anyone who manages to stand outside the mainstream media and the two political parties and views our economic situation objectively, I believe will agree with the Pope's observation. The point of fact today is that the market's doctrine of profits trumps the value of human life. For example, when a person is declared terminally ill with a limited number of months to live from cancer, almost categorically more chemo drugs are prescribed to bleed every penny from this person's illness.
Right.
And of course, we know that in a large number of cases, the chemo drugs, over 50% of patients, contribute to the patient's death.
Right. We should feel worse on the way.
And we should also make note of the Pope's other major document, the Laudato Si, dealing with the environment and the climate change, that are also more or less condemning the free market and its greed.
Yes.
So in your explanation of the different divine qualities that are attributable to the free market that lends it to being perceived as a religious ideology today, and let's go back to Gecko in Wall Street, the person who was said greed is good.
Right.
And to a cheering group of people, and with a few exceptions of gray-haired people, these were all young idealists. And
yeah.
recently, when I was finishing the movie Poverty, Inc., which you are in, by the way, and I was noticing on college campuses so many people, not all, but a lot, believing that they must get as much as they can for themselves, because there won't be anything left. So their parents, those who create this progenitor, are motivating them to believe that though that individual that has the most possessions, the biggest house, the best car, the most attractive or prosperous partner, somehow wins something.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have a culture now, especially in the millennial generation, that either those who are detached from reality completely, and they're just like living as if you were in a space station, floating effortlessly through the air, bouncing from one distraction to another. Or
with
those
your phone in your hand.
Yes. And the other group is committed to total determinism. They're the new manifest destiny. They'll make as much money as they can, climb as high as they can, irrespective of what it does to anyone else. So on the one hand, if you speak to these people one-on-one, and if, for example, you said, and I did this, by the way, and I did it down at Occupy Wall Street on the very first day, and I filmed it. It's an interesting interview. And I asked, because there was no other media there, so I asked, what are you against? What are you for? They said, we're against the people who use their wealth and power corruptly over others. I said, good, I support that. And they had each one had a different notion, but it all came down to that, inequality. And certainly any reasonable person and compassionate person would understand that. Then I said, and what are you for? We want to see people less suffering. I said, so can I assume then that you support women's rights? And they said, yes, of course we do. And I said, to what degree do you support them? The person asked why. I said, well, have you paid attention to where you get your clothes? I'm not saying this to be argumentative or condemning or make you feel bad, but when you're going to be for something, you have to ask yourself, how much am I for it? What am I willing to sacrifice to be there?
Right.
And what if that sacrifice makes me feel uncomfortable? Because a garment made, 800 million garments last year, by the way, were made in Bangladesh at 14 cents an hour. Well, that's slave labor. And many of those women are working 12 to 16 hours a day, and that destroys their health and life, and under harsh conditions. I said, so if you had a choice of buying something you liked inexpensively, but the woman had to suffer for you to do that, do you believe that that is supporting women's rights? And then they thought about that, and they, well, that's kind of a confusing question. I said, I don't, if you're against globalization, the very people who are masters of the marketplace, I said, are you against those that exploit, for example, the banking and credit cards? Do you have any credit cards? Mm-hmm. These, and I mentioned like Bank of America. Yes, they all did. Are you against McDonald's and the other companies that are using up a lot of our resources for a meat-based diet when a plant-based diet is better? Yes, they were. In fact, many of them were eating hamburgers and drinking colas and then wearing designer clothes. But most of the ones I spoke to came from rather affluent families. In fact, the person that was answering this, her mother was a physician and father was a attorney. I said, so do you understand how it could be confusing if you say you're for the right things, and indeed these are the right things, but you're not manifesting it in the choices you're making? And if those people who have committed themselves to learning, and fine, we all learn. I'm sure if we went back to the civil rights movement, went back to the anti-war movement when many of us were out there and active, that we would be just as contradictory. I'm not saying it for any self-righteous. I'm just saying at some point, and Chris Hedges, and I'm going to talk about Chris in a little bit, ask you to respond to something he said, we really have to stop trusting the system, working within the system, and believing the system somehow will honor what is right. You're suggesting, at least what I'm assuming here, that this system now believes it's beyond challenge, beyond reproach, beyond change. It is simply, as you put it, the large manifestation for the Wall Street, you put it in a capital letter, it's a deity. So how are these young people going to learn when our colleges are not giving them the tools they need so that they can get off the consumer ladder and stop deifying consumerism? Because capitalism is merely consumerism. Without consumerism, you don't have capitalism.
It's all over, right?
Without... Could you address these, please?
Yeah, okay. Well, a big list there, but let me say this to you, Gary. I've spent the last 50 years among young people, students, not just students at the university where I teach, but students in various many other places. And I see two different things, at least, and you've actually ticked them off. One is a suspicion that something is vastly wrong with the whole system which allocates its resources inequitably, causes so many people early death and starvation and all the rest. But on the other hand, a kind of a naivete about how this all comes to rest in their own lives, their own consumer choices, their own career choices even. There's not a whole lot of consistency there. Among some. Now, among others, I see a growing group of people who do get rid of their Bank of America cards, move their money to their little accounts that they have to a small community bank, and I see people who will go to McDonald's or won't go to one of the big chains, and it's growing slowly, but it's growing, and it's very widespread. And I think what we need to do is take advantage of the critical and hopeful impulse among young people and help them to become more consistent with it, help them to think about how this matters where the rubber hits the road. You know, I think about Pope Francis again, if I don't mind, I'm bringing him in. He not only talks about these things in such eloquent terms, here's a guy who won't live, he won't set foot in the papal palace. He won't go in there. He lives in a very simple guest house and eats with other people. He drives around in a small, inexpensive car. He will not dress up in the traditional finery, wears only a very simple robe, and lives quite simply. He's setting an example, in other words, of a kind of of a kind of a simplicity, which has its roots in religion, Christianity in particular. You know, the old song, it's a gift to be simple, it's a gift to be free. There was a time when religious people saw the connection and decided that simplicity and not conspicuous consumption and accumulation was be more faithful to the teachings of the gospel. So I'm not quite as pessimistic as you seem to be, Gary, about where the younger generation is going. In fact, I'm rather cheerful. For the last 2 years, I've been giving a course, not doing it this fall, called God and Money at Harvard. God and Money, and where I'm raising exactly these kinds of questions about consumer values, accumulation, insensitivity to how the stuff that you're eating dinner got there, or how the stuff you're putting on your back, the clothes, got there. Raising those questions and raising them in a very specifically or explicitly religious vein. And I'm amazed at how many students from all over the university began taking this course, from Harvard College, from the Kennedy School. A couple came over from MIT, a course from the Divinity School, but also from the Harvard Business School, believe it or not. Came the whole way across the river and took this course. Something was bothering them about the kind of vocational choice they'd made. And I was able to meet with them after class and talk with them about what their options might be given their managerial skills, and how they could be used in other ways. So please don't give up hope. Think of all those hundreds and hundreds of thousands of young people who got out there and worked and campaigned for Bernie Sanders.
I was just going to mention that. It was actually into the millions of votes that he received.
Right.
And here's my thoughts on that. I believe that each and every one of those people wanted to see positive change and saw Bernie as someone who could help guide that change. The difficulty was Bernie had never intended for his so-called revolution to be an independent party.
Right.
He didn't see the revolution challenging the political establishment. Rather, he saw his revolution going inside the Democratic Party and hoping for some form of reform or change on some of the issues. But
he himself
was a hardliner on Saudi Arabia. He supported Saudi Arabia. He did not condemn the war in Yemen, which is a genocide. He did not condemn the war in Syria. He did not condemn the war in Libya. He did not condemn the intervention and regime change. He did not condemn the coup in Ukraine. So a lot of the things that many of us who are progressives hoped that he would have, he didn't. Though he did, absolutely, and to his credit, he took on Wall Street. He took on student debt. But if I was him, I would have said, why don't we have a national student strike and teachers supporting you? If we believe that you should not live in debt peonage because of your educational expenses, let's close down American campuses. And I would close every damn campus in the United States down and let the teachers who supported the rights of the students to get a quality education without going into debt, and then demand that we change the bankruptcy laws so that students who qualified could create a bankruptcy. Now they can't. And a lot of them now we have debtors' prisons. So on the one hand, it was a movement inspired by a lot of belief that someone could change. It's just Bernie wasn't that person. And Chris Hedge and I both believe that he would lead this huge number of people into the Clinton camp, which he's tried to do, and it hasn't worked, and hopefully it won't work. That said, I have a little different way that I look at change in the United States. For example, what percentage of Americans are on a plant-based diet now?
I don't know, but I think it's growing a little bit.
It has grown. Now, mind you, in order to do my latest film, we had to look at everything on PubMed, and the National Library of Medicine, which the government officially uses as its resource on what is acceptable medicine. And we found over 20,000 studies in the peer-reviewed literature of how a plant-based, healthy diet will protect you against heart disease, cancer, blood pressure, allow you to live longer, etc. And then we also saw how virtually every single study in the scientific literature shows how meat and chicken, other animal-based products, actually increase disease, everything from colorectal cancer, breast cancer.
Yeah.
Now, that is not
it's
new.
It's beyond dispute at this point.
There's also more than 200 books on veganism. There's a lot of movements. Now, here's the number. There's exactly 2% of the American population are vegan and only 4% are vegetarian. That's 2%. So even when something is in the best interest of society, of the planet, and of the students, it doesn't mean it'll be embraced. So I have to separate out the ideal that if someone's willing to make a change politically, they'll make a change on the environment, they'll make a change for their health, doesn't always hold true. Now, while preparing for this conversation, something dawned on me, since we're headquartered in New York City in mid-Manhattan,
right,
and just a short distance from Wall Street, and there is the bronze-charging Golden Bull with a 107-pound testicle, and it's in front of old Lehman Brothers. And this has become an icon for aggressive financial optimism and prosperity that has been the cause of the American White House economic policies, including from your former president, Larry Summers at Harvard, and several other supporters. They've been in control for over 50 years, especially after the free market neoliberal theory of Milton Friedman came into prominence. And in some way, isn't the Wall Street bull the maturation of the golden calf in the Hebrew scriptures, which has become a symbol of idolatry, but was originally worshipped due to the seeming absence of a real living God? And today our culture struggles to embrace deeper spiritual values and ethics in the secular world, which is becoming increasingly atheistic, while maintaining churches becoming increasingly dogmatic and literalist. So your thoughts on this association and how economics and the principles of capitalism, especially, for example, the practice of usury, and phishing, which is defrauding a person with false information, that have played a role in religious thought and ethics over the centuries, and in particular, how important was the myth of Adam Smith's invisible hand of God in the theological evolution of capitalism in the 21st century? Please take your time on this.
Okay. Well, I like your reference to the big bull. And if you look at the cover of The Market as God, my new book, the cover features that big bull in a stained glass window. That wasn't my idea, but when I saw it, I said, boy, that does it perfectly. The bull has now been made the icon of this whole counterfeit cult that we're talking about. There it is. It's the commanding symbol. And I'm more comfortable as a theologian thinking about and dealing with the enormous power that symbols and rituals have, which is these are something that are always sometimes overlooked by the economists and other kinds of scholars, but they have enormous power, and they reach right into the emotional center of people's lives. We know from brain physiology that these messages go straight to the emotional center without going through the language or the logical grid. You're not expected to think carefully about the choices you make as a consumer. That would be, no, but they don't want you to do that. They want you to respond instantly. What is the biggest phrase used in these a million commercials? Act now. Call the number at the bottom of your screen. Don't think about this any further. This is not an appeal to a thoughtful populace. This is an effort to get a series of messages through into the emotional core where people are motivated. I'm delighted that this is now coming into consciousness, and that the Pope has helped do this so that we can discuss this, and as it were, sort of unmask the religious pretensions of the market god. Now, the problem is the marketeers don't want to admit in those words that what they're advocating is a religion, but they expect the deference and the credulity and the faithfulness and the lack of thoughtfulness and critical thought that many religious leaders have expected of their followers. They expect that. And I think it's to raise the question of it all and as forcibly as possible is part, not all, but part of the next discussion. May I just say one word about Bernie Sanders and that whole somewhat disappointing, as it turned out, a very hope-inspiring but ultimately disappointing episode. He created, I think you'd have to admit, Gary, he created a whole new space for political thought. He wasn't the perfect candidate, and certainly on many of these foreign policy issues that you mentioned, he just got it wrong. But he created a whole new space that nobody had created. Now look, all of those young people, millions, and not all young people, I'm not so young, and yet I was a Bernie Byrne, they're not going away. They're still there. The students last year, undergraduates at Harvard, the biggest thing that's happened since the opposition to the Vietnam War is they virtually closed down the yard for a couple days over climate change and the refusal of the university to divest from fossil fuels. And there's something bubbling here. There's something effervescent that needs to be helped and guided in a constructive and genuinely alternative direction. So that's the thing I think we ought to be trying to do, and doing it on all fronts.
I agree. Thank you. I appreciate that. And I believe the person who can do that is Jill Stein. Mm-hmm. And because she could take that revolution, and she is an outsider with principles, morals, and ethics, and she could make the changes that we need. Neither of the current candidates, Trump or Clinton, are capable of doing that, because they're both too connected to that oligarchical elite. Now, we've been told that the free market economy is the only path that will lead humanity to happiness and prosperity.
Right.
And we're being told in the height of
the land.
Yes. And we've all heard about the importance of globalization. It's a frenzy, especially after the fall of the Soviet Union. They gained tremendous steam in the Clinton years with the free trade agreements and founded of the World Trade Organization that would be promoting wealth and democracy and empower nations and societies throughout the world. Yet we have also seen the exact opposite: growing inequality, a demise in the middle class throughout developed worlds, nations, and most notably in the U.S. and the United Kingdom, and devastating destruction of the environment that has contributed to the increase in global warming. And furthermore, we're more than likely to find the planet's future ridden with wars and conflicts due to climate change and dwindling resources like clean water.
We certainly will, yeah.
And food. And we've heard this from our own Defense Department, which acknowledges that climate change is the single greatest national and global security threat. Yet the engine fueling this rapidly approaching threat is free market capitalism itself, which is really only free for those who can afford it. Would you take this further and outline what you foresee as the greatest dangers and threats to this deification of markets?
Yeah, well, I would start certainly with the collision between the built-in necessity of market capitalism to grow. Growth is not an option. You've got to grow. You've got to add markets. You've got to increase your market share. You've got to move all around the world. I mean, the missionaries, if you will, evangelists of the market faith, are more zealous and more willing to go to every small corner of the world than even the most committed Christian or Muslim missionaries. I mean, they're everywhere. They've got to pull everybody into this, or the whole ship begins to stall. You know, it's like Woody Allen's Shark. You know, a shark, it stops moving, dies, and they have to keep growing. Now, the problem is you cannot have infinite growth on a finite planet. And we are beginning to get unmistakable signals from what the Pope calls our common home that we've reached those limits. I think it's the eschatology or the theology of history of the market faith of endless growth, more and more and more and more, up against the built-in restraints and limitations. Now, the result of that, since we do live on a finite planet, is growing and a disastrous kind of inequality in who eats, who doesn't eat, who eats too much, who eats the wrong things but has a choice. It grows every year, as we know. It isn't diminishing. It's getting bigger and bigger, growing every year. We're going to start seeing, of course, population movements that will make the current refugee movement look sparse as people get hungrier and hungrier in parts of the world that are parched and move across borders. And the biggest wall in the world that Donald Trump can build isn't going to stop it. They're going to go where they need to go to survive. It's a very, very grim picture, especially when you think of the fact that we are now armed more than to the teeth, where we've just now sent, another $28 billion to Israel to build up their weapons cache because they're alleged to be our only reliable ally in that region. That's what I see, the destruction of the planet, and at the same time, the foisting of the suffering that the wastage of the planet brings with it on the people who are least able, the most vulnerable people who are least able to cope with it. That's a poisonous and explosive situation.
One very keen observation you make, which gives the market a kind of omnipotent, all-knowing quality, is its ability to zero in upon our greatest weaknesses and fears. And then to promote those commodities that address our fears and weaknesses.
To address them.
Yes. Associate this with the idea that God knows your heart's desires. So Go into that further and explain how the market and its masters capitalize on our fears for their own ends and its moral consequences.
One of the enjoyable things I did when I was writing this book was to ride my bike over to the Harvard Business School and sit in the library there and read a lot of the journals, especially the advertising professional journals, what the people in the profession of advertising write for each other. This is what kept coming out in everything I was reading. You can't just present a product. You have to discover what it is about your target audience, which is where they feel insecure, fearful, nervous, out of it, in various ways unhappy, and then find ways to relate the product you're trying to sell to that underlying insecurity and fear and uncertainty. Not that it's really going to touch that or solve it or heal that pain. Of course not. Nobody thinks it is, because if it healed the pain, they wouldn't be able to sell it next week. It's got to be alleged to reach where the itch is, so to speak. Let me give a good illustration, which I read in the Harvard Business School Library. This is a few years ago, I think I may even have this in the book. A few years ago, American Airlines discovered that there are going to be more and more women. This is about 20 years ago, who are going to be flying. And they wanted to get an enlarged market share of women flyers, women passengers on their airlines. So what they did was to invent something which came to be called the focus group, bring together groups of women, various places in the country, and ask them about things, not directly about airline advertising, but touching on that occasionally. What is it that you like or don't like about flying? What is it that you like about don't like about life? And very carefully catalog that. And then, now get this, adjust their message, adjust their advertising message to reach this growing audience, this market of women. They didn't make a single change in the product. They didn't widen the seats. They didn't put on more flights. They didn't improve the food. They didn't do anything like that. Nothing. It all had to do with tweaking the message so that the message would be more attractive to this audience that they wanted to reach. See, in a sense, it's all done. It's done with mirrors. I took that phrase, one of my chapters in the book is called All Desires Known. There's a famous prayer in the Book of Common Prayer that starts out, Almighty God, unto whom all desires are known, all secrets hid. And my suggestion there is that God, if you think there is a God, is already aware of where you're hurting, of what your secret desires and your pain is. However, the market God isn't. Market God has to find out about that sort of thing. And so they do market research, very carefully devised market research. You can take courses in most business schools and the psychology of market research, which is to uncover these hidden desires so that the commodity for sale can be presented in terms of that pain. I was about to say that need, but it's really not a need. I mean, the idea that you can't just sell to people who have needs, because you have to create the needs in order to sell the commodities.
The man behind that was named Bernay.
And, oh, yes, that's right. I remember that from the article.
And all of the current quest groups, current focus groups, don't make a better product. They change our perception of the product that we're given. I'll give you an example. When I see these debates, to me they're embarrassing because it does not tell me anything about what the person really knows. Because that person has been coached by groups of individuals. He might have five or six economists talking about, here's what you say about the economy. If you're talking about foreign policy, right, then they have foreign policy people. And almost all of these are coming from think tanks that themselves, these are the technocratic, what I call the professional elite industrial complex. There are about 200,000 of these people in foundations and think tanks and the media. They then create the public image of what they want to sell. Then the companies sell it. For example, if you look at, listen to what's going to happen after this upcoming debate. The first thing they'll say is, she looks presidential. He looked presidential. He looked sincere. She was smiling more than what she knows. None of that has to do with what it be. I don't care if they're out there in Bermuda shorts. I want to know what you know, and how, and what will you actually do, and how will you get it done if no one else is willing to cooperate with you, even if what you have is the right idea. What do you do if you have a good idea and you're in the wrong company, and if that company's been corrupted, and they're not going to ever have an unscripted, unrehearsed answer. So therefore, no matter what they say and how they adjust themselves on any point, that tells us nothing about who they are or their real qualifications. They're just mimicking. They're like a student crashing for an exam who is going to pass the exam but know nothing of the context of what is said. Now, that said, all we see now every day is either Clinton or Trump using words, and I feel haphazardly, that are using words like promise and restore, like a lost golden age. That's for Trump wants to return us to a golden age, make America great. Well, great, who was a great for? And there have been times when there's more in more equality, and there's times when there wasn't equality. So they're dominating jargon instead of substance in what they say. The markets have proven that no matter how far back you go, you'll find that they have been influencing people since the dawn of civilizations and the need for goods to be exchanged between people. So there is nothing inherently evil about markets. But what, in your opinion, might be a market that is equitable and not based upon one group taking advantage of another? And might markets not be so favorable towards advancing climate change? Because it seems to me that in one respect, Marx was absolutely correct, and perhaps the first ecological economist who warned that capitalism's pursuit of infinite progress and development would lead to global catastrophe, as you just mentioned, and what Marx called a metabolic rift was a ecological crisis he prophesized under capitalism between humanity and the rest of the nature.
He was certainly right about that. My thinking about the place of the market is as follows. Throughout most of history, not all of history, by the way, anthropologists say there were gift cultures for a long time before even the small markets began to develop. But put that aside for a moment. For a very long part of human history, we've had markets. The market has been one of many institutions, the family, the neighborhood, the nation, religion, education, culture. It's been one of the institutions in the society, and those other institutions framed it, or they guided it, or they restrained it. It was one voice in the choir, so to speak. But what has happened in the last couple hundred years is that the position of the market has been escalated more and more. The old theological term for this was apotheosis, you know, when something that isn't God is made into God. That's exactly what's happened. We've watched the apotheosis of the market, so that it has become, to the profit of some and the loss of most, the dominant value-creating, life picture projecting institution in the society. It's assumed that kind of power. My friend and colleague Michael Sandel here says, you know, we used to live with a market economy. Now we have a market society. And I would say, yeah, and we also have a market culture. And on top of that, a market religion. The whole thing now is marketism. That's the world we live in. And I'm hoping that we can at least, we have another term in religion we call demythologize. Demythologize, get rid of its mythical and symbolic power and bring it into the realm of thoughtful, logical analysis so that it can be de-escalated in its position and centrality in our whole society. And I think the Pope is helping.
Good for you. I really appreciate that insight. In my own journalism, I frequently draw association in the private corporate sciences with religious structures. For example, today there's a scientific cult, as it were, that dominates virtually all of medicine and the agricultural chemical industry, and referred to as science-based medicine or evidence-based medicine.
Yeah, right.
Now, of course, how this movement defines science is completely subjective and not based upon any gold standard of scientific methodology that you would find in the hard sciences such as physics or mathematics. It's very reductionist, it's determinist, and anything that cannot be measured or quantified or seen is simply regarded as illusory.
Right.
But
right.
What I find most striking among the primary scientists and spokespersons in this movement is their shared dogmatic and self-righteous belief in their own truth and the falsity in the claims of their critics and opponents.
Yeah, it's
and
a finally, kind of fundamentalism.
It is, and they all share another commonality. That is, they're all driven and supported by private financial interests.
Oh, yeah.
And in this sense, evidence-based science medicine functions as a dogmatic religion.
Sure. Did you see the exposure just this week, I think, of these two now dead and gone scientists from Harvard who, when their palms were crossed with silver, steered all of their research about sugar away from showing that sugar was really very damaging to us. And for 20 years, that became the line of the so-called scientific food people. And they did it. They were very, very generously subsidized in the shaving of their research.
Well, there was a time at Harvard where you had a professor, Frederick Stair, who was known as the Cornflakes Professor. He got a lot of money to Harvard from special interest groups involved with sugar and sugary products. Mm-hmm. And in fact, we were to debate, he and I, in October 5th, 1977. And he didn't show up. Barry Farber was going to moderate, and we were told he was out playing tennis. So years later, I debated with one of his student graduates who went on to get her PhD, and she ended up running a foundation that supports Coca-Cola and all these other companies. And yet, because
support
someone
Coca-Cola?
Came,
do they need support?
Oh yeah, big time. But not if you're the average person. You're not looking at the science. The trouble is today, much of science, much of medicine is viewed as a religion, and the practitioner is the high priest. For example, there is absolutely no science of any gold standard to show the safety and efficacy of vaccines. I've done over 14,000 hours of research on this. I've published over 40 papers, and I've done 3 multi-award-winning documentaries. There are people beginning to question once they see the evidence, but more often than not, the evidence they have to see is not a book, not a documentary, not a lecture. They have to see an autistic kid. They have to see a daughter that was healthy till they got a Gardasil vaccine and then regressed into a state of incompatible life. And yet the doctors, the scientists, they never seem to have that one element that is grossly missing in American society today and completely missing in the financial world, that is humility and austerity of spirit. So they do practice like a religion. Look at the Wall Street banks. Look at Wells Fargo today, intentionally cheating millions of people out of hundreds of millions of dollars, and no one goes to jail. No one is found criminally guilty. They pay $192 million fine or something like that.
Postage stamp money.
Yeah, and that's what we have. So your final comments were at the end of our show on this large issue, the deification of the marketplace.
Well, Michael, that's, yeah. Here's what I'll say about it. I could have, instead of calling the book The Market as God, I might have called it The Market is Not God. It's a book which advocates disbelief in this market God. And but in order to nurture and stimulate disbelief and distrust in the market faith, you have to expose it for what it is, for making claims that are very similar to, analogous to what religious groups have made in the past, and telling us who we are, what's wrong with us, what's the good life, what we ought to be doing with our lives, showering us with its stories and its parables and its narratives to guide us in the way so that they can continue to profit by us. I don't think, however, that it's inevitable that we have to perish under this system. I think we can fight back. I'm encouraged that there are a lot of people, including large numbers of young people, who, if they thought about it carefully and got it together and got organized in a way, could really take it on. And I'm going to continue to do my best for as long as I'm around to try to make that happen.
We all appreciate your major contributions to our lives. I want to thank you very much, Professor Harvey Cox, from Cambridge, Massachusetts, author of The Market as God, Harvard University Press. And by the way, he is one of the most preeminent theologians and Hollis Research Professor Emeritus at Harvard Divinity School in the United States. Thank you for being with us today.
Glad to be here, Gary.
I'm Gary Noll. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Thank you all for listening.
Mother, there's too many of you crying. Brother, there's far too many of you crying.